I would say 9 out of 10 times that I preach. There are those 1 out of 10 that are otherwise. I am chomping at the bit. And those are the times when I want to say to anybody that wants to introduce me, just get out of the way and let her blow, like introducing a tornado. This is a great portion of Scripture. And one of my problems during the middle hour is after having preached the passage once and having a chance to think through it again, I always write a dozen notes to myself about all the things that I could have said or should have seen. It is a tremendously significant text. So significant, I've struggled over titles, as you will notice. I started out with the title, Double Trouble. Then later in the week, I thought that it would be better something like A Double Dealer Gets a Double Deal. And then finally, thinking back in the old days of television and the counter spy, I thought of the title, I Led Two Wives. And I decided to stay with that. I'm sorry, folks, it's compulsive and I can't help myself. As I look at this story, I think of a story, I've heard several of editions of it, so I suppose that it is true, of a man who was looking for a classic car of a particular type. He, like I, watched the newspapers. And one day he saw in the paper an ad for this particular car that he had been looking for $100. And he knew there had to be something wrong. Either the car had been run through a crusher, and you could take it home in a cube, or perhaps there had been a misprint, and probably it was not hundreds, but thousands, which would have been more accurate. He couldn't help, though, the curiosity factor, and so he called. And when he called, a woman answered the phone, and she said to him, no, the car is not demolished, it's in very nice shape. And no, there was no misprint. The price was $100. Well, his pulse began to quicken, and so he went out to the place to look at the car, and it was beautiful. So he said to her very quickly, I'll take it for $100. His conscience, though, began to bother him a little, and he thought, it really isn't right to do this to a woman who doesn't know what she has. And so he said to her, ma'am, I really do want this car for $100, but I have to tell you, that is a valuable car. And I just cannot, in good conscience, give you only $100. I have to tell you, it is worth much more. I know, she said. You see, my husband has just left me and run off with his secretary. He sent me the title and he said to sell the car and sell him whatever I got for it. And I am. Doesn't that feel good? There's a sense of poetic justice to that. I must say that that's about the way that I read Genesis chapter 29. It feels so good to read of Jacob getting a dose of his own medicine. And so I think that we are inclined to read it with a mentality of revenge. But in the process of doing that, I think we make a very serious mistake. And the mistake is basically this. We come looking at Jacob as a double dealer and a deceiver. And we see Jacob getting what he deserves, and we understand that to be he gets stuck with a defective wife who should have been factory recalled, and he has to live with her, and that is his punishment. That's the way we look at it. And I would like to suggest that mentality is wrong. And I think the Scriptures will back me up. I hope they will. Let's look at the first section. I call this Love at First Sight. And it probably was, I think. Jacob left the encounter at Bethel, and it seems to me that a load has been lifted. If you could take the analogy of Pilgrim's Progress, of Christian, he has been to the hill of Calvary, and the burden has been lifted from his back. Literally, the text says he lifted up his feet. I suspect he drug his feet most of the way to Bethel. Now he lifts up his feet because God has assured him of his presence, of his provision and of his protection. He came to Bethel as the son of his father who had his God, so that he referred to the God of Abraham as your God to his father Isaac. Now it is my God as of chapter 28. So he is on, and he has a whole new lease upon life, because now he is related to God, and he goes, therefore, with, let's say, a lightness in his step, an anticipation and assurance of the presence of God in his own life. Now, he arrives at a well. I do not think it is the same well as the well that the servant came to when he was looking for and found Rebekah, a wife for Isaac. It is there, I think it was a spring, and it was a spring located just outside on the suburbs or the edge of the city. This, I take it, is more like a stock watering pond, obviously smaller, but a sort of cistern, and the water was not such, I think, that you and I would have drunk out of it, especially after three flocks of sheep had finished. But it is a well, and Jacob is looking for his way. His map skull was left at home, and so he comes to this. And just like pilots fly around water towers to see what city they're in, he buzzed in on this well to see where he was at. And he asked these shepherds, I take it, by the way, Jacob is 77, I take it these are shepherd boys, as they usually were, so that he is the senior member, but he's a stranger too. He comes in and there are three flocks of sheep surrounding or on the outskirts of this well, and he takes this situation in, and we're given this background. These flocks were gathered at the well, and then at an appointed time, this large stone was taken off of the well, uncovered it, and the flocks would come down to water, and then the stone would be placed back. Now, that seems a little unusual. It seemed unusual to Jacob, and he's going to ask a question about it, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But there is this water, this well of water where the flocks were gathered in anticipation of watering, and that puzzled Jacob. And he raises the question in a minute. Then he comes and he encounters the shepherds and he engages them in conversation. And the first question that he asks is basically, where am I? Or he says, my brothers, where are you from? He didn't want to say, I don't know where I'm from. He just said, where are you from? And that told him where he was. Where are you from? And they said, we are from Haran. And I'm sure that Jacob was greatly relieved. And then he says, asking now about the family that he is looking for. He had come not just to a place, he had come primarily to a family to seek a wife and to seek refuge. He said, do you know Laban, the son of Nahor? And they said, we know him. I really wish that there was some way that the Hebrew or the Greek or the English or something else would give us the tone of voice. Yeah, we know him. I don't know whether they clenched their fists. You know, what do you want to make of it? If Laban was the kind of guy that we read him to be, that's probably all they were willing to admit. We know him, yeah, and he'll know him soon. And he said to them, is it well with him? And they said, it is well, and behold, Rachel, his daughter, is coming with the sheep. I am not sure whether that means there is Rachel coming with the sheep, or whether that means, as our custom is, she will be here soon with the flock of sheep that belongs to her father to water them, as we, in fact, are waiting to do also. Now, this is the point at which Jacob's curiosity gets to him. He is waiting for Rachel to arrive, and so he asks this question and makes really a suggestion. He says to them in verse 7, behold, it is still high day. It is not time for the livestock to be gathered. Water the sheep and go pasture them. If you can believe this, some of the commentators, two of them that I read, basically thought that Jacob was asking the shepherds to get lost. I suppose that they thought that Jacob was there watching Rachel, and he said to himself, get lost, guys. Go water your sheep and get out of here. I'm going to meet her alone. I can't believe that. Not yet. I could believe it later, but not yet. I don't think he saw her. I don't think that he had any indication of being alone, but I think that this is the significance. He looked, as a guy who had been a shepherd for years, if these are young boys, as I think they were, then they obviously didn't really know and probably didn't care too much. So he says to them, look, the sun's still high in the sky. Now, your sheep are gathered around this watering hole, And sheep do this every day. There's no grass here. They can't get fat on what doesn't exist here. And you're marking time waiting for the well to be uncovered. Why don't you just open up the well, water the sheep, and go back out to pasture before you gather them in for the night? This doesn't make any sense. Any good shepherd would tell you that. That's true. But there was I call it a convention. I think there was an agreement that had to do with the well. Notice their answer. They said in verse 8, we cannot, not will not, not do not, we cannot. There is some moral constraint which restricts that. What is it? Until all the flocks are gathered and they, not we, they roll the stone from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep. Now, let me suggest what may be happening here. Wells were a natural resource. We might look at them as an oil well. If we were to go out somewhere and find an oil well, we would not simply dip in and take all that we wanted. It belongs to somebody. It is a resource. Water was a resource too, and especially in a dry land. So what the shepherds are informing Jacob is the rules for the use of that well, which I think did not belong to them. Belonged to the owner of the well. There were certain stipulations. There was a certain agreement that was made as to how that well was to be used. And as I understand it, while it may have been more convenient to do it some other way, they would water their sheep whatever way the owner of the well would let them. And the owner of the well apparently had somebody appointed who would come once he didn't. The owner of the well wasn't going to go out every time some shepherd came by and says, I'm ready to water. He says, okay, I'll send a guy out to roll off that big stone, which I assume was there to keep it from being used illicitly and also perhaps to keep it from being polluted. So he would send somebody out. After all the shepherds were gathered with all of their sheep, there would be men sent out. They would uncover the well. The sheep would be watered, and then the shepherds would go their way with their flocks. So when Jacob says, why don't you just water your sheep and go back out? They were saying, we can't. The well isn't ours. We do not have the free right to use the well any way we like. We use it the way it is prescribed. That is a convention. It is a part of life. Now, notice what happens. That sets a backdrop. Doesn't seem to be significant until we get a little farther down. That sets the backdrop, and now Rachel arrives. Now, I must say, I may be wrong, and I realize that the wording of the New International Version does it differently, and of course, that is a translator's decision. I find the events that happen at Rachel's arrival exactly opposite of, if you want to use the term, convention, tradition, practice, that which is customary, accepted, so on. It looks to me like it's awkward, like it's backwards. That may tell us something about Jacob. It may tell us something about Rachel. Now, I would have thought that in a strange land, probably Rachel's father had said to her, now watch out for some of these strange shepherds, and given her some clear words of warning. What happened was, the order is, Jacob watered her sheep, kissed her, first instance of kissing cousins right here, kissed her, then introduced himself. Now, doesn't that strike you as strange? I really would have thought, that Jacob would have come up to her and said, hi, I'm Jacob, your cousin. My mother is your father's sister. And maybe after a long introduction, he would have given her a peck on the cheek. He wept. I think, by the way, there's some pent-up emotions, and you need to understand. Remember Isaac, it says, when Rebekah came, he was comforted at the loss of his mother 3 years before. I think that there is a tremendous family lack which he has left behind, and I think there was tremendous pent-up emotion as well. But I find it very interesting, at least, that he has thrown everything in reverse. I would have expected introduction, a little kiss, then water the sheep. But it's exactly the opposite, or at least so it seems. Again, then, Jacob may have done that which was contrary to custom. And by the way, Rachel was an interesting gal, if she was willing to be kissed by someone whom she knew not yet. That is why I'm sure the translators of the New International Version say that in verse 12 that Jacob had told Rachel that he was a relative. That's a translator's decision. I'm not sure that we ought necessarily to go that way. It is interesting. The New American Standard does not. That's the background. That's the meeting. And I suspect there is love at first sight. Can't prove it. I suspect it. Now, the second part is what I call 7 years till wedding night. That's the only thing I could think of that rhymed. I'm sorry. It's an interesting section because it is the agreement that is made. Notice in verse 13, Laban came. Some of the commentators say because of the intensive word that is used that Laban was a little too mushy here. He was kissing in such a way that it was almost forced, it may seem. And so he ran and embraced him and kissed him and so on and then brought him to his house. And notice that it says, then he related to Laban all these things. What things? Well, I would suspect there had to be a number. He probably related to Laban how he had arrived at the well, how he had met Rachel, and the sort of initial meeting, I would imagine. He surely would have told Laban about the affairs of his family, because Laban would have been greatly concerned about his sister, Rebekah, and would have great interest in family matters. Certainly, these things would include that. Plus, they would serve to convince Laban that Jacob was, in fact, who he said he was, and that is a cousin of Rachel. Which, I guess I should add, would not be a bad thing. Cousins were considered pretty good eligible material for marriage at this stage in the culture and in history. I suppose, too, that when it says all these things, that Jacob at least in some way acknowledged the deception that had occurred and his role in that and all that necessitated him coming down to Padan Aram and especially coming down empty-handed. You know, Laban said, hey, the last time I saw anybody from your place, they had 10 camels with them. Well, there had to be some explanation. I think probably the circumstances of the deception were a part of what he said. Now, Laban then concludes from this, surely you are my bone and my flesh. And he stayed with him a month. I think there is something significant in that statement, surely you are my bone and my flesh. I will not dwell on it much now. But let me suffice it to say that so far as the text informs us, Laban did not have any sons yet, only 2 daughters. And a man who did not have sons was a very worried man. And in that day, there was a convention, again, where a man could adopt a relative. And in particular, he could marry him to one of his daughters. And he could have him then be the heir of his possessions, carry on the family title, and so on. And also, that man would be responsible for caring for him in his old age. I think that Laban's wheels are already starting to turn. Aha, he says, my bone and my flesh, eh? And he's saying to himself, this boy has potential. And he did. Now, notice what happens when he stays that month. 2 things, I think, primarily happened. One of them happened between Jacob and Rachel. You see, Jacob was a shepherd, if I understand things correctly. And Rachel was a shepherdess. They spent a month, and he worked. She worked keeping sheep. His job had been keeping sheep. That tells me that there is a remote possibility that they spent that month in fairly close proximity. Well, at least we can conclude this. Jacob got to the point after that month where he had good reason to stay in Padan Aram. He had, over that period of time, had his affections won, so far as Rachel was concerned. So Jacob has good reason to stay, besides just staying away from his brother back at home. And Laban has good reason to keep him. You see, Jacob was an unknown quantity. Jacob did not come with 10 camels laden down with dowry. All he had to offer was his hands. But during that month, Jacob didn't sleep in a hammock outside the tent of Laban. He worked. And in the process of that, Laban washed. And he said, hey, this is a man worth having. This is a man worth having as a hired servant. This is a man worth having as an adopted son. I want to keep him around. So you see, there's a mutual interest now. Jacob wants to stay there. Laban wants to keep him. Now they must come to terms. So in verse 14, Laban says to him, or verse 15, he says, because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be? What's your price to stay on? Here's where an interesting little hitch comes. And Moses informs us of that. It's obvious what Jacob's response was going to be. But there was a little problem that had to be prepared for. Laban had two daughters, and Rachel happened to be the younger daughter. I do not think Laban was telling stories when he said, it is not customary for us to marry the youngest before the oldest. I think he was absolutely right. And I suspect Jacob knew it and chose to disregard it. So Moses tells us there were two daughters. The name of the older was Leah. That means wild cow. I don't think that proves a thing. Jacob probably thought it did. And Rachel. But notice verse 17. Here is where we really get off the track, in my estimation. And Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful of form and face. Now, come on. Let's admit our prejudices when we come to the text. Don't you really envision some ugly little gal with pop bottle glasses and she's just feeling her way around the tent? I mean, she was a dud, a reject. Who'd want to marry her? And Laban was so crummy that he pawned her off. I mean, he got top dollar for that gal. 7 years. I would like to suggest that that is wrong. First of all, let's look at the word weak. Very interesting word. That word weak, that would be an abnormal way to render it. It's not really catching the flavor of it. In Genesis chapter 18 and verse 7, here we find Abraham. The strangers are coming by. Abraham runs out, greets them, begs them to stay for dinner, and it says he went out and he killed and slaughtered a choice, tender calf. Now I want to ask you, did he go out and say to his servants, I want you to get the scrawniest, grotiest looking calf and finish it off and then fix it? The word there is tender. It was a word that conveyed a choice animal, not defective. Now, then we go over to Genesis chapter 33 and verse 13. Here is where Jacob is on his way back to the promised land with his two wives and all of his children and all of the cattle. And his brother Esau comes out to meet him. And Esau says to him, listen, I want to accompany you back. I'll stay with you all the way. Jacob says to him, don't do that. Because, see, you are mounted up. You can move quickly. I have a young and tender, or he uses the word frail, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Translators use it there. Frail. The children and the cattle are frail. That means that they were young. You could not drive young children. You could not make them move quickly, nor could you do that to young animals. No concept of defect. It is of that which is tender, delicate, is the sense. Do you follow? Nowhere is that word ever employed with any suggestion of defect. Never. Point number one. Therefore, we, I think, are right to conclude with some commentators that she is not a factory reject. She is not some kind of a dud that Laban has to pawn off in some crummy way, as he does, but rather that she has delicate eyes. And if it is speaking of her in a physical way, it is not demeaning. Now, I suspect, if you want to know the truth, I suspect that Jacob was looking for a wife like some people look for a horse. And that is, he wanted one with fire in its eyes. And in that sense, she didn't fit. if this is the way we're to understand it. Now, let me move you to the other word, which nobody, and therefore I tell you, I am out now on the end of the exegetical limb, and it is cracking. Okay? No commentator has ever suggested in print that I have read what I am going to suggest. Yeah, I know. Close your notebooks. We're all looking at the word weak, but we're not looking at the word eyes. What does it mean when it draws us to her eyes? May I suggest you drag out your concordance someday and look up the word eyes. And you will discover that eyes are a demonstration of one's character. Okay? Let's take a look. For example, at Proverbs, it says that there are seven things which God hates. One of them is the uplifted eye, the haughty eye. What is that speaking of? People that walk around looking in the air? No, it's talking about pride. When it says, for example, that you, when you go into the land, you are not to look with an evil eye. What Moses is talking about, the same writer, what he's talking about there is not to look with impure motives. And you're saying, let me see now, how many years is there left before this property has to be redeemed? And you're calculating it all out. That's a material, impure motive. So the eye was an instrument. When our Lord speaks, remember in Matthew about an evil eye? He is talking again about motive, about character. I suspect that it is possible that when it says that Leah's eyes were weak, I think that it may be speaking about her character, that she is a gentle, non-aggressive, but a beautifully quiet person. I may be wrong. I guess a lot of people would say you probably are wrong. I do not think she was defective. And I do not think that she was second class. Now notice something else. Rachel was beautiful of form and face. You know what that translates to today? She was sexy. That's what it means. Does it say anything about her character? Does it? It just says, wow! Whew! Look at that woman. See, that's what the television's saying. I mean, if you get this ugly mole on your face, you've got to cover it up. You know, all of these kinds of things. You've got to brush with toothpaste that gives your mouth sex appeal. That's it. Nothing about character. Just about outward appearance. I would like to suggest that Jacob's decision was made on the wrong basis. Do you notice what happened when Isaac was getting a wife? He wasn't even there. But do you notice what the servant does? He prayed to God. There's nothing wrong with looking good. Don't misunderstand me. But you notice that being beautiful was a fringe benefit. It was not the primary requisite. And the servant, when he prayed, which Jacob never did, to our knowledge of Scripture, when the servant prayed, he did not pray, give me a Miss America pageant winner. That's what I want. He said, God, I want the woman who meets the qualifications, and I want a woman who has such character that when I ask for a drink, she's going to give me a drink and she's going to water my camels. Character is what that servant was looking for. Not Jacob. He was looking at outward appearance. And I wonder then if the description of Leah and Rachel may not be a contrast in terms of character as opposed to appearance. I do not want to press that. At least I will challenge anyone who says she is defective. I do not believe that. And I don't think the text bears it out. Now, having said all of that, Jacob loved Rachel. He surely did. And so he said, I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. I think that was premium dollar. He did not have a dowry to give, so therefore he had to work with his hands. And it says, you will notice in verse 20, Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her. That's an interesting statement. Do you think that the time didn't bother Jacob? I know he was 77 years old, and you may say he's so over the hill he wouldn't care when he got married or if. Oh, I think he did. I think he did. I think what it's saying is that he did not consider the price to be significant in comparison with the product. I think that's the point of it. What's 7 years? It's like saying, what's $10,000? Look what I'm getting. That's the point. But it's not saying he didn't care whether he had to wait for 50 years to get married, because look at verse 21. And Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife, for my time is up." Notice he was more interested in the time being up than Laban was. And he says, "Give me my wife that I may go in to her." Now, folks, that's physical. He did want to be together with his wife. And by the way, that is the very thing that got him in trouble. Do you notice that Isaac had his physical appetites paved the way for the deception that came to pass? He loved wild game. So he says to his son, "Go out and get me some wild game and fix me a meal." It says he loved Esau because he loved wild game. Now, my wife says that I'm way out on a limb, and I am. But I have suggested that maybe while Isaac loved wild game, Jacob loved wild girls. And it's probably not true. But he did have an appetite. And it is his appetite and his eagerness to do what he has suggested in verse 21, which consummates a marriage with a woman he didn't choose. Very interesting. All right, so the deal is made. Now notice what Laban says. This guy was as crooked as a snake. I do not know what his thought was. I mean, you know, if we can only go back into his mind, I don't know whether he had this plan from this moment, but he knew how to answer in such a way as to give you one impression and to leave it wide open for whatever he did. He says, "Well, it's better for me to give her to you than I should give her to somebody else." What he didn't say was, "Work 7 years for me." That's what my friend Hugh says. Always put it in print. Get it in a contract. Make it clear. Well, there's a little verbal agreement. Better for me to give her to you than somebody else. But he didn't say 7 years and you get it. Left that little loophole. And he used it. Now, whether that was in his mind when he said it, and if it was, he carefully chose the words, or whether he reconsidered. It is interesting that Jacob later says, "You changed my wages 10 times, you bum." And this may have been the first. 7 years, I get Rachel. 7 years, he got Leah. All right. Now, surprise at first light. Wow. This is great, and this is what we've been waiting for. Jacob says, "All right, time's up." I think Laban would have been glad to forget it and let it go over. I imagine that this was early on the morning of the first day of the 8th year. I can well believe that. I remember when I got my driver's license. I want to tell you, I didn't get there 2 days late. I didn't get there 2 hours late. I mean, the minute I was eligible, I was there. And so was Jacob. And it says, Laban gathered all the men of the place, and he makes this tremendous setting, which, of course, was typical, customary. But I think it did several things. One is, it kept Jacob probably up late, and he probably drank freely. And that may have contributed toward the events of the evening. And then notice it simply says in verse 23, "And it came about in the evening that he took his daughter Leah and he brought her to him, and Jacob went in to her." Interrupts that with a little parenthetical statement, and then it says, "So it came about..." By the way, that parenthetical statement is probably an excellent illustration of discretion. What he does not tell us in detail about that event, which he did tell us in detail about the deception of Isaac, down to the garments on the hands, Hollywood would have made the whole movie between these verses. Scripture says nothing about it, but I want to tell you, it's realistic, it's believable, and it's true. Well, in his eagerness, he went into the tent, and lo and behold, the next morning came. I would pay anything for looking at that man's face. He wakes up. "Hallelujah! Look at that sun! Look at it, honey! Ah! It's Leah!" He did wipe him out. What a way to ruin a perfect day. By the way, something very interesting about that. I want you to listen to this, because our society says that one's physical relationship is very, very dependent upon physical appeal. I want to suggest to you from what doesn't happen and what does, that Jacob was a very happy man that wedding night with Leah. Now, Leah never changed. He spent many other nights with her. But you see, in his mind, it was the way he looked at her, not the way she looked, that made their romantic love what it was. And I want to suggest to you, it is not really, ultimately, and I'm not saying this justifies any of us letting ourselves go to seed, but it is not really the outward appearance that makes for tremendous relationship physically. It is not. It is your attitude toward one another. Unfortunately, Jacob thought it was Rachel. All right. So the morning comes, and now the words that are just a delight to hear. He goes to his father-in-law. The marriage is consummated, folks. There is no way out. And he goes to his father, and he says, "What is this you have done to me?" Isn't that interesting? That's what Pharaoh asked Abraham. That's what Abimelech asked Abraham. That's what Abimelech asked Isaac. And that's probably what Isaac asked Jacob. Now Jacob just asked it too. "What is this you have done to me? You have deceived me." That, folks, is the pot calling the kettle black. "You have deceived me." And notice what Laban says. "It is not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the firstborn." I believe that was true. So then he goes on and he makes a concession. But you'll notice what he does is he has now gotten top dollar for his first daughter. And now he gets top dollar for his second daughter. He gets top price. He came out smelling like a rose. "Complete the bridal week for this one, and I will give you the other one also for the service which you shall serve me for another 7 years." Completed the week, he gave him his daughter Rachel. And then it says, "And so Jacob went into Rachel also. And indeed, he loved Rachel more than Leah. And he served with Laban for another 7 years." A couple of very interesting things to consider. We are inclined to think that God really got even with Jacob by giving him Leah the reject and letting him live with that. And I want to suggest to you folks, Leah was not the reject. She was not. Let me suggest three reasons. Reason number one, Leah, not Rachel, was the mother of Judah. And Judah was the son, remember Reuben was the firstborn, who also was born of Leah. But because of his incest, it was Judah who is the one who is to have preeminence. That means the blessing and the birthright reverted to him. And he was not one of Rachel's children that had that privilege. Very interesting. Number two, the firstborn, one of the advantages of that was that you had twice the inheritance of any of the other children. Two times. Now look at this. It is not a one-to-one correspondence, and I don't want to press it too far. But we can say this with great confidence. First, Leah had twice as many children and then some as Leah. Leah had twice as many children as Rachel. Leah's servant girls, her concubines, had twice as many children as Rachel's. 2-to-1. Isn't that interesting? We'd call that coincidence. Last point in support of that. Look at chapter 35 and verse 19. At the burial of the two wives. So Rachel died. Chapter 35, verse 19. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem. Now notice Genesis chapter 49. Jacob is dying. He is giving the blessing to the sons. And notice what he says after he instructs his sons to bury him at the cave of Machpelah. Verse 31 of Genesis 49. There they buried Abraham and his wife, Sarah, there they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah, and there I buried Leah, not Rachel. Isn't that interesting? I am suggesting then that Leah was not the reject that Jacob thought she was. She was not the curse Jacob thought she was. But in the sovereignty of God, God chose to bring the blessing through her. Next observation. I think it would be safe to say that Jacob's choice of a wife was based on romanticism. I think it would be safe to say that. I am implying somewhat, but it looks to me like Jacob was looking at the exterior only. If Jacob's decision was a romantic one, we might have to question whether it was the right one. And I say that in a day in which romanticism is exalted. And oftentimes it is exalted that what is romantic is also spiritual. And I simply challenge you folks to take a good, long, hard look at some of the romantic decisions that you and I are making, myself included. I am not sure romantic decisions are necessarily right decisions. Jacob learned some lessons. He learned, one, that he ought to look at character rather than sex appeal. And I think he had to learn to look at convention. Convention. A lot of Christians are non-conventional. They don't like conventions that society may lay down. Now I'm beginning to understand the story about the well. The well was a matter of convention. You see, Jacob couldn't understand from his pragmatic mind and thinking only of success and figures and studies that had been done on the growth of sheep. He knew that the best way to grow sheep was to water them and get them back out to the grass. But that flew in the face of convention. Somebody owned that well. Somebody said, we will open it when all of you are gathered around. We will put the stone back on it. You water the sheep. What did Jacob do when he saw Rachel? Convention flew to the wind. He took the stone up and says, here, I'll water your sheep. I don't care what those other people think. I don't care what the owners think. That's tough. But that was convention. Another convention was that the first daughter was married first. He didn't like that convention either. But Laban stuffed it down his throat. I want to suggest convention is something we have to deal with. And romanticism doesn't necessarily overrule it. One final point. And this landed on me in between services. You know, I've always wondered why Jacob came to his father-in-law empty-handed. You ever thought about that? Hey, listen. He had been given the promise of blessing by his father. He had been given the promise of blessing by God, but he was empty-handed. Do you realize none of this was necessary? Do you realize none of this was necessary? 7 years he had to wait for the wrong wife. All he would have had to do was to trust God. But you see, when he left the revealed word of God, he left the resources of his father. Think about that. Sin separated him from fellowship with his father and his mother. But sin also separated him from the resources of his father. And therefore he came and all he had was the work of his hands. He could have come to Laban and he could have said, here are the resources of my father, give me my wife now. As the servant had done. And they'd let him go. But when we reject the will of God, and when we choose to sin, folks, we choose to leave behind the resources of God and to use only our hands. And whenever we do that, we will find that what we trust ourselves to do always gets scrambled. What a beautiful illustration about the consequences of sin. Totally unnecessary.
but totally the result of sin. Now, it's almost 12 o'clock, and I want to give you a chance to make a question or a comment besides what is the cowboy score, which I suppose is just about to get going.